attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. Today I've caught Ali Owen, one of the advertising world's true goodies. Few have done more than Ali Owen to help make advertising a more diverse, equitable, inclusive and interesting industry. The founder of the legendary Brixton Finishing School, Ali is basically creative Dumbledore, ushering in generation after generation of incredible new multicultural and neurodiverse talent, which is precisely the kind of talent the advertising industry is so hopeless at finding for itself. She's also brought that Brixton brilliance to her own free virtual program called the Adcademy that gives 2,500 students a year the training they need to get their start in Adland, and is one of the brains behind Visible Start, a program helping women over 45 re-enter the workforce. Ali says, when people are going, oh my God, there's a slump, well, if we know that if you have a diverse management team that produces 10% more earnings than a non-diverse management team, I'd pull that lever. Welcome to the show, Ali.
Thank you so much, Giles. I really appreciate it. Also, I love the fact you swore in that introduction, kind of set the scene for the reality of what we're about to talk about.
Yeah. Yes, well, start as we mean to go on. 7 quick fire questions, Ali. Tea or coffee?
Tea.
The Guardian or the Mail?
Oh, God, Guardian.
You were to both.
And also, obviously, I love the Metro. Metro, I love you as well.
Number 3, Liverpool or London?
That's difficult because my mum's a Scouser. I'm going to go London Pool, a blend of the two.
Well played. Number 4, Highbury or the Emirates?
Highbury. Yeah. Nice. Yeah, definitely. I used to sit in the clock end. For those of you who don't know, we're referring to the home of Arsenal, the greatest team the world has ever seen.
Oh, I don't know. As a big Tottenham fan, I'm deeply troubled that we have another gooner on the pod. We've had a few of you recently. Mr. Dave Dye was on the other week.
There are a lot of us about.
Yeah. Oh, they're right. Even your friend Mark Lewis as well, who was far too vocal on the Arsenal front.
Brilliant.
Number 5, neuromarketing or neurodiversity?
Neurodiversity. It's just nature. No, neurodiversity is just natural.
Nice. 2 more, hieroglyphics or emojis?
As hieroglyphics, I love a bit of Egyptianness. And yeah. I do like a hieroglyphic. Though one would argue they're essentially the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like this one's a tap-in. Lastly, Katie Hopkins or Anthony Hopkins?
Anthony Hopkins, clearly. Even in Silence of the Lambs, he's more appealing. Would you rather have a meal with Hannibal Lecter or Katie Hopkins? I think it's still a tough choice for most people.
No, not at all. Amazing. Oh, wonderful. Brilliant. Listen, Ali, thank you so much for joining us. Of the 150-plus guests we've spoken to in the 5+ years we've been running, I feel like our opener will really speak to you in a way, probably more so than it has any of our previous guests. So to start the show, we ask every guest about their path to where they are now. And importantly for us, there's huge value in people understanding that talent doesn't always step out of a shiny university straight into a shiny career. So could you start by telling our audience, what was your first ever job? And then what you regard to be your first proper job?
My first ever job was selling shoes in Stead and Simpson on a Saturday when I was 14.
Nice.
Yeah. I got £1.11 an hour, which I thought was quite a lot of money at the time.
Do you enjoy it?
I really enjoyed it. And you learn a lot about customer service. I mean, it was knackering, you know, shoe shop sales. It's not glamorous. And it was the kind of average customer was more mature, so you dealt with a lot of elderly feet, put it that way.
Elderly feet.
Yeah, elderly feet. But yeah, it was fun and it taught you a lot about how to chat to people, how to sell stuff and how to be part of a team as well.
Yeah, we had Scott the Boom Morrison on a few months ago, and I remember him talking about selling shoes at a similar age. And he says that even today, he can look at people's feet and correctly guess their shoe size. Did it equip you with that talent?
Definitely. And I would never, ever try on a pair of shoes in a shop without a pop sock or socks on. That's my top tip to everybody, because you don't know who's tried those shoes on before you. And some people actually do try on shoes without any kind of foot sheath, aka a sock.
I prefer foot sheath. Amazing. And then where did that lead?
That led to a fish and chip shop, the McDonald's, basically. Okay. I went into catering. So I did, from 14 to when I left uni, I did pretty much every, what would be described as gig work now, everything you can imagine, from counting pedestrians in an alleyway for the town council, to serving fish and chips, to doing, you know, even going around pubs collecting for charity. I'm not entirely sure how legal that was, looking back. We got paid a tenner for it. And then I did a lot of catering, yeah, which was kind of your classic, you know, once you get into catering, it's really easy to get other jobs, but it's quite hard to get out of catering.
Yeah. So all of those are very much frontline customer-facing gigs, aren't they?
They are, and certainly a Friday night in Portsmouth on the till at McDonald's gives you the skills of a UN negotiator. It really does. Never be rude to anybody on the till that's going to produce food for you, because there's many things people can do.
I dare ask. And were you on the tills then? You weren't back kitchens?
I did do some cooking in the back, but they tended to put, and this is very of the age, on a Friday night, they would put the girls on the tills because it would be less likely to have fights.
Yes.
It gives you the kind of a dipstick into what Portsmouth was like in the 80s and 90s. Pretty challenging is how I describe it.
Yes, yeah, that's fair. Yeah. I think that's fair. It's funny, I do this annoying thing, Ali, which you're probably starting to clock onto already, but when guests talk to me about stories like this, I immediately think of previous guests who might have said the same thing.
Yeah.
And Mimi Turner of the LinkedIn B2B Institute was again a very recent guest, and she made a similar point. She worked in McDonald's, and she also highlighted the fact that all the women were put on the tills at Friday night, you know, pubs kicking out time, for precisely that and perhaps one or two other reasons. So it's you've certainly added credibility to that tale.
I mean, now I wonder whether that would be legal, thinking about, you know, the new laws that have just come in where employers have to protect their staff from sexual harassment. Sticking a load of women on the front line between hungry, drunk males and their food is probably...
It's questionable.
It's a questionable practice. I hope it's ended. Yeah.
Yeah. But the other thing she said was that the actual back kitchen area of McDonald's is almost like a masterpiece of process and efficiency.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. And the training was amazing as well. I was there for quite a bit because they paid minimum wage, which was rare where I grew up. There was a lot of non-minimum wage jobs. And training was fantastic. They tried to get, you know, obviously it was a real mix of young people, but it was a meritocracy. And they were really keen on people going into management as well. So I was offered the choice between being a manager, but I went to uni instead, which I must admit, I think was the right thing for me. Who knows? I could be a Mackie D franchise millionaire.
Yeah.
Let's face it, everybody loves
Who knows?
McDonald's, yeah.
And so what was so tempting about university? Did you go to university with any kind of career plan in place?
No, not at all. I'm the first person in my family to have kind of gone past 16. So there was no planning. It was more about getting out of where I lived. So I went to Liverpool because that was the cheapest hall accommodation rent per week. Because, the accommodation was in Toxteth, which at the time... It's not the kind of bougie Liverpool it is now. And I just wanted to get away from home. That was, you know, honestly. And that, you know, that was it. Yeah.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that, you know, being the incentive. I'm sure that's shared by thousands.
Thousands.
What did you go to study and why did you choose it?
I went to study ancient history and archaeology, which turned out to be mostly a major in Egyptian art, which is absolutely bizarre when you consider what kind of school and stuff I went to. But I had a really good history teacher, and I tended to be a very annoying student. Like, if I liked you, I'd be amazing. If I didn't like you, I'd be a nightmare, which turns out I was ADHD, autistic, and a pain in the arse as well, you know, on top of it. So, but I was really into it. I was really into the whole study of humanity through objects and that kind of, you know, thinking about how your ancestors lived and their view on the world and how that has affected our worldview today. Yeah. So it's really, you know, the fashions that come in and out of how we view different types of community, people, even God, is just really interesting.
There's so many strategists and people in advertising who have gone via a kind of history course of sorts. It's quite interesting. And yet I think you're the first person I've ever spoken to on the pod who studied the same as one of my brothers, Gareth, which is ancient history and archaeology. He was absolutely obsessed with the Egyptian period. I mean, he's latterly gone on to run pubs, so I'm not sure, you know, whether he's kind of used it in any of his career today. But yeah, really interesting topic.
Yeah, no, I also think, I listen to a lot of history podcasts. I'm a member of the House of Stolen Things, aka the British Museum. Let's just call it what it is, people.
It is, let's be honest.
I mean, yeah. In fact, you know, I'm always like, what? Can you imagine if, you know, if somebody came around my house, took my telly, and then I saw it in their house, and they were like, no, we're going to take better care of this telly than you would. And I'd be like, that's an heirloom. That's my, you know, the family telly. You know, I just find it amazing that we can get away with claiming we're somehow better at taking care of the stuff we've nicked so it shouldn't go back to the people we stole it from, essentially. That's what it is.
Yeah, I don't know if it's just topical because I know there's you know, our king is on some sort of, you know, world tour jolly, but he's certainly been challenged about it, I think I've seen in the news recently. But I don't know whether growing up you don't really think about those things.
Growing up, I was, I was still in the 1970s when I was very little, in the 80s. It was still very empire-led, you know, and even now a lot of, you know, when you think about a lot of our history and teaching and, you know, especially when you talk about Black history or colonial history, it's just not taught in a way that's actually true. It's taught in a way that, you know, still, yeah. I certainly think when I think about my landscape of the world as a child, I would have thought that Britain was some kind of saviour and we went around helping people. I mean, obviously then as you grow up and you understand what colonialism and empire is, which is the going into places and pillaging them for resources, people, assets. You know, literally it's like stripping a company when you take it over. It's a very different view. But yeah, I think we were kind of, I don't know, is it propaganda? I suppose it was propaganda, yeah. We were given, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Definitely, yeah. And it takes a while to deprogram yourself from that because, yeah, because you've been brought up with it.
Yeah. I mean, why would you question it? You're learning from people who you've been, you know, taught to admire, at least respect, that you assume it's right. How did you go from that to the University of Liverpool then into your first kind of media advertising related job then? Was that just kind of serendipity or was that intentional?
Yeah, it's just pure luck. I arrived in London and I'd kind of at that point run out of banks that would give me any money. So I had, and this is true, precisely £5, £5 note. And I was sleeping on my mate's floor in Ladbroke Grove at the time. But I could type. So I started temping, secretarial temping. Also, back then, even though I did really well in my degree, I didn't have any concept of careers because that wasn't necessarily something that we did, if that makes sense. I hadn't heard of marketing, advertising, or publishing. I had, you know, for me, being a secretary was as good as it was going to get. And one, you know, you'd turn up at this little temporary secretarial place called Office Angels, and you'd wait for somebody to call in sick, then you'd go into their office and type for a day. Sounds very antiquated, but that's essentially what you did. And one day somebody at a publishing house was sick. I went in, I thought, oh, this is good, isn't it? Lots of people my age, buzzy. And yeah, I managed to talk my way into being a personal assistant there quite quickly. And then I talked my way into selling the advertising space. So yeah, as soon as I understood what the opportunity was, I was in.
Nice. And you were in for a good few years before you kind of sidestepped into other related industries.
A couple of decades. Yeah, definitely. Wow. So I did lots of, I had many, many different roles, from strategy to branded content to commercial director of a content agency.
Was that John Brown?
Yeah, that was. So it was all the content for Waitrose, John Lewis, RBS, etc. You know, it was as a mother, a single parent who did work flexible hours, I had, a good career, which wasn't necessarily normal at that point because there weren't many women who were allowed to have flexible hours. Yeah.
No, I think that's testament to you. There's a word, and it's probably not the right time to bring it up, but it's too late now, so I've started. But the word relentless comes up a lot when researching your energy, and you know, perhaps one of the reasons, you know, not to suggest it's at all near the top of the main reasons why you've had so much success in what you do. But I wonder if it was that kind of relentlessness that allowed you to have so much success, because I've got your experience and your, I suppose, a CV of sorts printed out in front of me, and it's incredibly impressive.
It's weird, isn't it? Because at the time, when you're in it, you're doing it, you're just thinking of survival. So to other people on the outside, it may look like you're being really successful as, you know, a woman paying a mortgage on her own. You're actually much more, right, how am I going to stay alive for the next payment type thing? So I think relentless is a good word. You're relentlessly pursuing anything that would give you safe harbour. We know that if you're not necessarily a traditional type of person, which I wasn't, it's harder for you to stay in and it's harder for you to thrive. So you do have to have, I suppose, a bloody-minded aspect to your nature. And I've certainly got that.
We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on building a funnel. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
My first sort of proper paid weekly job was a holiday job as a student, which was driving a forklift truck at the Ribena factory.
Ah, Call to Action, episode 11, with the one and only Rory Sutherland. Not what we were looking for, but hang on a minute. Ah, there we go.
Was there a point during this career kind of journey of sorts, what was the catalyst for Brixton Finishing School? Because I would imagine... And I don't want you to point fingers at any particular organisation, unless, you know, of course you want to, but was there a particular moment or a time or experience that made you really, you know, say enough is enough, someone needs to kind of fix this, you know, structural problem, I've heard you call it?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think like anything, you know, a snowball can start out quite small, but as it rolls down the hill, it becomes bigger and bigger, collecting more snow. Now, in my teens, I was an activist, so I was, you know, into protesting against stuff. And then in my corporate career, to keep my corporate career, I certainly tried to fit into the institutions I was in, despite those institutions being really, really unrepresentative of, you know, all our communities. And I think I got to the point when I hit about 45, which is an interesting time for a woman anyway. You get quite angry about that time because you realise you're never going to have it. You know, you always think it's going to get better. Then at some point you just go, it isn't going to get better unless I do something. So it's an incredibly cathartic time. It's like an unravelling that, yeah. And I was at a big media name. They employed Katie Hopkins, who we referenced earlier. I had a moment of clarity that I was running a significant revenue line, therefore contributing towards her salary. And the idea that I was paying Katie Hopkins to write stuff had never, ever been one of my career goals. In fact, I was probably really against that. And I just had that moment where you sort of think, what am I doing? And I thought, right, somebody's got to change all of this. And where I live as well, in Dalston, I live on a lovely little estate. And when you get to the end of my road, you can look down and see the Shard, gherkin, like, you know, Wizard of Oz land at the bottom of the road. But the odds of anybody from my street ending up in those kind of elite professions were zero. I was the only one on my street who had that kind of job. And quite like two of the girls on my street, with only 68 houses, had got first and couldn't get jobs, you know. So, you know, a lot of stuff that I'd maybe hadn't been aware of, started to be aware of, had been affected by, but it all kind of came together and I just decided to step out and fix stuff, which looking back, I was possibly insane. But that's really good. I do think that, you know, a moment of pure not sanity, if sanity is doing the safe thing, happened. And despite the fact I had no savings, so certainly when I set up Brixton, it was done on a remortgage or two, turns out three, and an Amex, which is the worst thing to take money out on. Never take money out on an Amex. So also I'd never done anything that was educational before. So when you look at it, if you were to, you know, if somebody had actually said to me, write a business plan, present it, there's no way that would have, but I didn't do that. I just did it. And I sometimes feel that's the best way to do things. Just start doing what you, the next thing that's going to get you to whatever you want to do. And then the world I've discovered can manifest around that. But you do have to be the one driving it. And you do have to be the one that takes the losses when they happen. And going back to relentless, you have to be relentless because you're the one variable that you can get more out of, which is...
I really like the way you just describe, I guess, the process of not necessarily knowing what you need to do next. I think as a, I mean, maybe as a country, I was going to say as an industry, but I think maybe as just human beings, we're often guilty of finding something successful and then kind of trying to reverse engineer the path that person chose to then replicate success. And actually the people who genuinely achieve success are more often along the similar lines as you. They don't necessarily consciously say, oh, I've done X, now I need to do Y. They just have that relentlessness, as you say, to actually fix the thing or do the thing. And that's the driving force, not the, you know, which step did you then take? It must have been really difficult. Obviously, financially, it was difficult because of your remortgaging and your Amex. How difficult was it to get off the ground?
It was, do you know, the thing I did when people say, oh, somebody does something, it was a collective effort from early start. One of my talents is telling a story about what I want to do and people wanting to help that story happen. So from the beginning, even though I may have been that key engine driving things forward, there were other people putting, you know, helping me build the machine as we set off. And that could be, you know, people giving counsel, volunteers, you know, giving space for the first school. So my top tip to anybody who's trying to get anything off the ground is keep telling the story of what you're going to do. And you'll soon find there's a whole lot of people who want the same ending as you. And they're willing to do, you know, nobody, you know, even a little bit to help you. But yeah, that first year, you know, looking, I mean, do it when you're younger is my top tip. I'm a bit older now. I am knackered most days. I don't know how I used to pull, you know, 7 days a week. There's no glamour in this. It was grind. It was grind for very little return to get that pilot off the ground. And also having to accept getting over yourself quite quickly as well is the really top tip. You are going to get things wrong. You are going to say the wrong thing. You are going to not understand some of the structures you're in. So you're kind of flailing around trying to get something off the ground and just accepting that, yeah, it's going to hurt in times, but you just got to keep going.
I want to touch on just how successful you were from the off, not just in creating Brixton, but also the success that your, you know, first year's grads had. But before I ask you to expand on that, when you talk about fixing it and actually creating it, what was it? Like in your mind, what was it? And what was it there to achieve?
Yeah, at that point, my understanding was at, you know, creating a fairer, more accessible entry-level pathway into our industry, rebuilding back in that kind of comprehensive meritocracy I benefited from in the 90s when I got to go to uni for free. Yes, that happened. You know, when for a moment, if you were clever and you worked hard and you were good at something, you could have the same shot at it as somebody else with familial, you know, familial money or inheritance or whatever. And I'm not saying that sort of, you know, 30 odd years ago it was completely fair, but it's a lot fairer than it was, than it is now. You know, it's just so unfair now, sadly, so stacked against you. You know, uni now is like 70 odd grand for the three.
That's terrifying. Yeah.
It's terrifying. And, you know, we do annual surveys of our kind of alumni pool. There's about 4,000 of them. And in, I think, 2020, one in 10 were saying they couldn't afford to go to uni, even though they had the right qualifications. Now it's like one in four. So you could be getting, three A's at A level, but you're having to go out and work immediately because you're part of a family that needs your money that day. Can't have you pissing about doing another 3 years. So it's like short term is, I think that's the big thing. People need to, if you've got no money, you're just going to think about short term goals because that's survival. It's not fair. And you could, I just think we're missing out on so much talent because the structures are so unbalanced.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we could probably have a really, deep discussion about whether to succeed in the creative industry, you should go to university or not. Or maybe that's probably the wrong way of articulating it. Maybe it's like some of the best, people in the industry I know maybe didn't go to university. That said, I know, I'm pretty accurate and confident saying that if I rewound my life 25 years and started applying for jobs without a degree, which I just happened to have, I would find it nigh on impossible to get, an interview, let alone an opportunity. So it's more about just giving everybody the opportunity to say yes or no to university rather than yes.
Yeah, I think there's that. But also as well, not making not going a penalty.
Yeah.
Thing. So it's kind of like, if you can't afford to go, you're being gaslit as well.
Yeah, that's true.
Saying you're not good enough. Even right down to your immigration points count on a degree. Mm. And so it's like every single structure depends on you having the willingness to take on what is essentially a small mortgage at 6.3% at 18 that you start paying the day you take the loan out, not the day you graduate. So, I mean, it's just, yeah. I mean, I think as much as I'd like to turn this chat into the unfairness of the uni system, that's what we've got. Can't change that bit. But what I can change is getting in. Yes, if you want to do the uni bit, you can do it, but you can also get in by not doing the uni bit and come through us. Or you could do your degree, then you're going to have to come through us anyway, because the connections between academic institutions and employment are broken. And that's why we're a finishing school. We're a bridge between academia, whether that's 18 or 21, and the real world. And we're all about real life work experiences.
Yeah.
You're work ready.
And on that point specifically, yeah. One thing I love, to be honest, I wasn't aware of, as much as I'm familiar with Brixton Finishing School, I wasn't aware that you taught office etiquette as part of the program. Yeah. And that's just such a wonderful thing to have even considered. And I wondered your earlier point that you hadn't ever done anything in education. I wonder if that rather gave you an advantage to think of all the things that the creative educational kind of universities don't cover.
I honestly think as well, as somebody who's neurodiverse and also had done a lot of gig work, so I'd done a lot of catering, etc., my first time in an office was just gobsmackingly bamboozling. Obviously everybody else seemed to know what they were doing. They probably didn't. But the whole dark arts of the office, how to interact, is a presumption based on a set of rules that actually only a limited amount of people may have experienced. And obviously I'm too institutionalized now in our bubble to really, but I remember, it's just bizarre. Just the whole, how do you speak to people in an open plan office? Just bizarre. I'm going speechless with how odd it is that we just don't teach that or give people some rules about it. So we do a lot on that, actually. That's probably the biggest thing we obviously do a lot on critical thinking, personal ownership of your outcomes. The surviving in the office space is generally the thing that will undo you from a class perspective, which is not necessarily your fault because, let's face it, who decided the fish tank you're entering had to be?
No, exactly. Huh? Exactly that.
Yeah, that's what we're stuck with. We're stuck with these structures at the moment. We can only change them when we're in them. So we are having to flex a little bit to get into them and step.
Well done. It's just such a wonderful thing to have even considered, and to me anyway, as someone who has in the 15 years of running GASP has given people their first job in our industry, I've noticed firsthand how unaware of, you know, how to write an email, for example, people can be, even though they've just spent nigh on 60, 70 grand on a 3 or 4 year university degree, and they arrive not knowing how to write an email. And to me, it's just baffling, but it makes complete sense that they wouldn't. Why would they?
Yeah, there's so much stuff, even like how to say hello to people. I think we don't, because we're slightly older, we're not maybe as cognizant about the impact COVID had on like work experience even, which is a very uninclusive space. So obviously recently we had 2 years where nobody had any work experience, and that's had a bit of a knock-on effect as well. We've kind of got a lot, and also the virtual stuff, there's just multiple layers of rules to understand without actually us accepting that this is actually, you know, it should come with a guidebook. You know, when you go to those rough guides when you go to a different culture.
Yeah.
A rough guide to office culture where you can look up, you know, not microwaving fish to be for a start. Don't do that. I had somebody do that once.
That was, or broccoli. I've had broccoli a few times.
I mean, why would you do? There's a sign where we're very blessed. We've got a residency at Mother, and we did have a no microwaving fish sign, I think, because somebody, you know, I'm all for everybody, but you're just like, why? Just, yeah, there you go.
I mean, you mentioned Mother there. One thing I'm keen to make sure that we achieve in this episode is that people out there, whether you're familiar or not with Brixton Finishing School, how can people get involved and support what you're doing?
Well, number one, please follow us on LinkedIn. It's Brixton Finishing School, and Instagram is Brixton Finishing School. And we are essentially a way of connecting those who want positive change in the industry, which I hope is many of the individuals listening to this, with the programs we run. And through the programs, those people can deliver mentorship, coaching, give content, give roles as well to amazing talent. And I think the best thing about Brixton is, even though sometimes we're called D&I, essentially we're just about making sure that companies get the best talent, because currently the structures don't allow all of the best talent to get through. Yeah. So if you imagine a best in show, best in class, we are truly that. I'm trying to think, like the Royal Academy of Music, but for advertising. I'm going to blow my own trumpet there. That was a bit of a pun.
No, that works. No, I'm happy with that. That's a very good, very good analogy. And it's exactly that. How can you have best in show if not everyone who's possible to be in the show is even considered? Yeah. So it's just, as you say, the structure itself doesn't do what it claims it does. As if this wasn't enough, I suppose, to focus on, you've also set up AdCademy, Visible Start, which I, you know, mentioned in the intro. But I know you've launched something very recently, the Finishing School Foundation. What's that all about?
So what I'm going to do, should I just mention Visible Start, just to clarify, we collaborated on. So that's actually a product between the Invisibility Project, us and WPP. But that's women over 45. The Academy is national for 18 to 30-year-olds, which is amazing. The Finishing School Foundation is a separate charity to Brixton Finishing School. Brixton Finishing School is not-for-profit. We attack structural, we're here to kind of force structural change. So you imagine like an auntie that will kick down doors for you, get your CV round, help you on your office etiquette, that auntie. The Finishing School Foundation is about supporting the 20% most challenged financially of our communities. So if you're a young person and you're not in education, training or employment, which is actually, sadly, a really growing segment of our population. I think it's about 16% of young men now in that group and 13% of young women. Then we're designed to kind of practically help you to be able to get access to our programs and hopefully get into the world of work. So all our programs are free, but actually to do all of our programs, you're not going to be able, if we're teaching you for an hour, you can't work in that hour. Does that make sense?
So
we give out living cost grants. We're looking at things like mental health support, because definitely in that NEET audience, massive amounts of mental wellness challenges, which because of the state of the waiting lists aren't getting resolved. Massive amounts of undiagnosed neurodiversity and little support. Where I am in North London, the waiting list I think it's about 6 years at the moment. You can imagine, and that's just to get, you know, access to, if you've got ADHD, medication that in, you know, a couple of hours could change your, you know, the course of your life as somebody that is diagnosed and on medication. So, and other stuff like maybe you're in Grimsby. We know our industry is only centered around certain urban hubs, Manchester, Birmingham, Bristol, London, Glasgow, Edinburgh. You want to get a job, then you're going to have to move to one of those hubs so we could lend you the deposit or give you the deposit for a flat. So it's really like practical auntie, uncle with her purse opening up. Yeah, just to try and level the playing field. And the reason for that is when I first launched Brixton in 2018, we weren't as buggered as we are now financially. You were able to do the summer school, which was like 10 till 4, and still do a 5-11 shift in prep and work at the weekend and probably get your rent away. That's not doable now. So if we're all about it being truly equitable so the industry can benefit from all of the best in show talent, then the charity needs to do that practical stuff.
Yeah, brilliant. For anyone who didn't catch it, NEET is an acronym for Not in Education, Employment or Training. And as you say, it's sadly a growing number. So again, you know, kudos and huge respect to you and the collective team. I can't have you mention Visible Start without also giving a very big shout out to the, you know, the incredible Jane Evans.
Yeah, and Jackie Duckworth.
Yes.
As well. So
absolutely.
Visible Start is Jane Evans and Jackie Duckworth's project, and we collaborated on bringing it to life. So I would say it wouldn't be honest to say I launched Visible Start, but I was certainly a very happy member of the
club. Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure you were a catalyst. But yeah, I'm a huge fan of Jane's. I haven't had the opportunity, sadly, to cross paths with Jackie, but I'm sure that between the three of you, you are more than a force. We will link, obviously, anyone listening to this episode, you'll see links to Visible Start and all of the wonderful collectives and initiatives that Ali is involved in this episode listing. But I'm going to go to listener questions now, Ali.
Ooh,
go on. So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. We've had quite a few in. I'm going to cherry pick two, starting with another Jane, actually. So Jane asks, would, could, or should big agencies allow you to grow Brixton finishing schools in residency of their businesses to help grow your reach? Now, it's encouraging, obviously, to know that Mother is doing precisely that.
So I'm presuming Jane means, would we support in-house programs?
Yes, I believe so.
Definitely. So Visible Start is an example of an in-house WPP program. And we've definitely done stuff with Saatchi's. We supported their internship program for like, I think, 4 or 5 years, where we helped create the kind of pathway and everything. Anyway, whether it's a school like Brixton itself has got 56 partners, we believe that learning from all the village empowers all our kind of emerging talents with like a real spectrum of stuff that will benefit them later. But however somebody wants to work with us, if they want to make the change, I'm here to make the change. So I'm kind of like, I wish I had the luxury of saying, no, we're just going to do it this way. But the reality is we want to be really useful. And if that's useful, yes.
Yeah, well said. Well, I mean, useful, I suppose, in that context means effective as well, doesn't it? You just want to fix it. That's brilliant. The other question I was going to ask is from Philip Oakley. I know Philip. He's a friend in the US. He's a brilliant marketer. He says, how do you get top executives who are laser focused on the P&L sheet and investor returns to recognize the real value of diversity and inclusion?
This is such a good point. So if it is somebody I know that's just about money, the blessing is all the research from the big four accountancy firms demonstrates clearly that the more diverse a team and more inclusive a team you have, the more money you make, the more innovation you make, the more people stay, the more productive they are. And this is all from like McKinsey, Wall Street Journal, etc., even Deloitte, you know. So I tend to double down on that. And the reality is there's not a top 100 company in the world that does not start with the phrase, we need the best talent. Well, if that is true, then you need the best talent. I'm going to take that at face value. And you're not getting it now through the current routes to talent you're choosing. And we need to be added into that route. So for me, I think the proof's in the pudding. When you look at the performance of our alumni who've gone on to win Black Pencils or be named a campaign's top 10 emerging stars, they are adding value to the bottom line every step of the way. And certainly from a pitch winning point of view, let's remember that it's not just your gender diversity stats that matter. Your social mobility stats will increasingly start to matter, as will your kind of ethnicity stats as well. When someone's just like, say, for example, Diageo is deciding whether they want to give you your business. You know, the reality is if you're selling stuff, you want to sell it to as many people as possible. How can you do that if you're not actually creating coherent marketing campaigns from insight based from as many views as possible?
Well said. Brilliant answer, Ali.
Like it's my job, isn't it?
It's like you know what you're talking about.
Yeah, amazing.
Oh, that is amazing. Brilliant. The final part of the interview is our four pertinent poses. Starting with, what advice would you give to your younger self in Portsmouth?
Do you know what? I feel very sorry for my younger self. I'm glad. I was very driven. But I would say take care of yourself because nobody else will. So one of the things I didn't do well, but I do well now, is look after my health. I think if you're brought up in a certain way in a certain time, especially as a woman, you're expected to burn yourself out for the service of others. And actually having this thing, apparently they're called boundaries, new discovery of mine, has been instrumental. Boundaries I apply to myself has been really useful. So yeah, think about what makes you happy. Life is very short. Not all of us have to do lots of amazing things. Some of us just have to do the best we can every day. Just do the next right thing.
Yeah, amazing. Well said. Number two, if you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why?
If I could banish one thing, it would be the ability to disregard the importance of things that in 2020 people said were very important. So I think there is a bit of a magpie thing going on. We like shiny things. There's kind of a bit of fatigue around change making. The reality is you cannot say that you are behind something then not be behind it. That is hypocritical and dishonest. And also it's bad for business. So if anything, if you just do the right thing, because by doing the right thing, you will financially have more return.
Yeah, I mean, you've touched on a few reasons why it might happen. I think you could claim all sorts, whether it's virtue signaling and people claiming that they want to make change, or fatigue, I think, is probably one that people don't necessarily think of as often as it's probably, you know, relevant.
Isn't the idea that 4 years after 2020, we're all a little bit tired of trying to do change? What about the people from the communities that have been fighting all of their lives for, you know, experiencing that? I just think it's really disrespectful to use the word fatigue for 48 months of part-time effort towards a kind of outcome that would actually benefit us all. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I find it really disappointing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I totally agree. I totally agree. And that's what's so sad about the use of that word, is that you know that's often what it will be. And people will be talking about what's the next thing we should be communicating about. No, that thing you talked about, that still needs to be done.
The far right was rioting on the streets of Britain over this summer when people were saying, I'm just a bit tired of diversity. You know, it's not, and you know, it's like, it is even, you know, it should be the people of this country should be your priority because your business is based here, and doing good business and doing the right thing should be your priority as well. Anyway, I'm not going to rant.
No, let's
please do the right thing.
Do the right thing. Number three, any books that you can recommend to our listeners? They don't have to be, you know, industry related or.
So I'm going to go for a bit, you know, have you ever heard of a book called Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine?
Ah, why do I know the name Eleanor Oliphant?
Book winner back 2017. And right. It's a really amazing story about yeah, just somebody who finds socializing quite challenging, mental wellness, trauma, but it also is about overcoming things as well. So as much as I cried at points during this book, it's by Gail Honeyman, by the way, it is an amazing story about how you can recover from some of the crap that's gone down through kindness and friendship. And I think that is a really positive message.
Amazing. Eleanor Oliphant is completely fine.
Fine, yeah.
Brilliant.
Honeyman.
That's not come up before. That's brilliant. At number four, we always dedicate every episode to someone and we bestow that honour to our guest who has to give the reason why. So would you dedicate this episode, please?
Yeah, so this episode is dedicated to my close friend and neighbour, Carol Tully, who sadly passed in July, much earlier than she should have, and her three wonderful children, Gemma, Georgia, and Sam. And Sam was a student on Brixton Finishing School in 2023. And Carol was a childminder. She was my neighbour. She raised my daughter, thus enabling me to just focus on bringing money in because I knew my daughter was safe and in a wonderful home with full of people that loved her while I was at work. And also Carol was an incredibly, incredibly intelligent woman who went back to uni in her late 40s to get a degree because she'd had to leave school at 13 to care for her dad. There's so much more to her story, but she definitely taught me what living, you know, she never complained. She was so helpful. Everybody in the estate loved her. You know, the funeral was massive. She was, I know the word selfless, but she was. And yeah, I think sometimes people like Carol don't get celebrated enough. And people who aren't very nice but are wealthy do.
What a beautiful dedication. This episode is very proudly dedicated to Carol Tully and Carol's children, Gemma, Georgia and Sam. Thank you, Ali.
Oh, my pleasure. And yeah.
As a final call to action, everyone can check out the listing where we'll have links to everything discussed from all of the initiatives to Brixton Finishing School to Eleanor Oliphant is completely fine. How else can our listeners get more Ali Owen?
Oh, God, if you'd want more Ali Owen, I mean, sometimes I think whether if that's a good thing. LinkedIn, please follow me on LinkedIn. Also, please follow Brixton Finishing School. We've obviously got the website, www.brixtonfinishingschool.org, and you can explore all of our kind of courses there. We've also just launched a new amazing site called careeradventures.org, which is for 14 to 19-year-olds, and that is all about introducing at a much earlier age the myriad of incredible careers you could have in the creative industries, whether you're a mathlete or, you know, somebody who can get their parents to buy them things, or maybe you're a great strategist, aka your mates do what you say on Fortnite, which I always think is the test of any strategist.
Yeah.
People are actually people to do it though. Yeah. So I'd recommend that. So we're always looking for support, particularly funding. Yeah. We do a lot, but we're always on that fine line between breaking even in a year and not, and we're a not-for-profit. The charity, the Finishing School Foundation, is officially launching week commencing the 11th of November, I hope, maybe the week commencing the 12th. But yeah, again, that, you know, that would make a real difference. I think people don't realise what a difference an hour of their time or a donation will make. But yeah, it does really, really count.
Yeah, amazing. Well, Ali, listen, thank you so much. Not only for what you do, which I wouldn't be able to do credit to in a closing sound bites, but please, everyone listening, do check out everything from Brixton Finishing School to Visible Start, Adcademy. I love the sound of careeradventures.org because I don't think people are exposed to the wonderful careers that are available until much later in life. Thank you for talking about your history. Thank you for giving me the House of Stolen Things. I'm never going to forget that. And thank you for, thank you for sharing your story. It's been a huge pleasure.
Oh, thanks so much, Giles. I really enjoyed it. I appreciate it.
And finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do share and review the podcast. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online, or you can email the mouthful, that is calltoaction@gasp.agency.
I can't get no call to action. I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try, and I try.